Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Hey folks, what's up? What's up? It's the Man of Steel. I'm Michael Steele. Welcome to the podcast. So glad you could be with us. Of course, you can find us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, all those good places where you get your podcast thing going on. I'm excited about today because I've known this guy for a long time, as they like to say, when he was a pup reporter. Back in the day, I was a county chairman. He was a young reporter doing his thing on the beat, and we got to know each other and worked together a little bit over the years, and it's a real pleasure to have him on. John Ward, he's a journalist who has written about politics, religion, and culture for over 20 years. He is the senior political correspondent at Yahoo News and lives in Washington, D.C. He's got this great new book out, folks, we want to get into a little bit. It's called Camelot's End, Kennedy versus Carter and the Fight That Broke the Democratic Party. John Ward, welcome to the podcast, Talking with the Man of Steel.
Hey, Mike, thanks for having me on, man. You're selling yourself a little short, though. You were lieutenant governor when I first, I think, met you.
Was it lieutenant governor? Oh, I thought we got back a little bit further than that. Okay, well, I'll take that. That's good, too. That's good. All right.
Yeah.
So it's a pleasure having you on, and let's jump right into the book. I love where you go with this book, because it really does, not just in terms of what happened inside the Democratic Party, but you can see sort of manifestations in today's politics inside the GOP. But let's just focus first on where you go. You talk about, you know, the Carter presidency being on life support. The Democrats are nervous. They're concerned about whether or not the president really has the chops to pull this one out. And they turn to Ted Kennedy. Pick it up from there. What's the narrative that you dig into in this very fraught relationship between Kennedy and Carter?
Yeah, I mean, the thing that is important to set the scene with is that the 70s were not a great time, right? I mean, I was born in 77, so this is not something I lived through. This is something that had to be conveyed to me by talking to people. And I'll never forget sitting down with Anita Dunn, who was the top advisor to President Obama, and has a long history in Democratic politics. She talked about how dark the 70s were. And I was talking to her back a couple years ago, you know, 2013, probably.
Right.
So this was like 6 years ago. And in 2013, the national mood of the country was okay. I mean, it was nothing like what it is
right now
and has been the last few years. And so at that time, I was talking to Anita. She was conveying to me anxieties about the nation's place in the world.
Right.
You know, joblessness was going up. Inflation was out of control. That meant that middle-class families had a hard time making big purchases on houses and cars and other, you know, big-ticket items. You know, you had major crime problems. The murder rate was at its highest point, really, in the nation's history at that time.
Right.
Big cities were just a total mess. And there was a number of other items. You also had sort of the ongoing backlash or sort of PTSD from Vietnam War, Watergate, all of this. So it's just not a great time in the country's history. And then you have an energy crisis in 79. That's really what sort of causes the Democrats and the country to turn on Jimmy Carter.
Mm-hmm.
And he gives what's known as the malaise speech. We can get into that if we want. But he gives that speech in the summer of 79. And Kennedy kind of decides at that point he's going to challenge Carter. And so in the fall of 1979, the polling basically showed Kennedy up 2-1 on Carter. And so the expectation at that point was that Ted Kennedy was going to be the Democratic nominee for president. And it's important to point out, I've got the list right here. Of all of our presidents, only three have failed to be renominated by their party in the primary.
Interesting.
Millard Fillmore in 1852, Franklin Pierce in 1856, and Andrew Johnson in 1868. In the fall of 79, it really looked very likely that Jimmy Carter was going to become the fourth president to suffer that humiliating fate.
So what happened? I mean, how, I mean, the malaise speech, which everybody remembers, it was the ultimate downer, particularly given how we tend to look at our presidents as delivering aspirational, words and feelings in tough times. Carter was rather frank and honest about it. He was just like, hey, this is where we are. And this is what's happening. So Kennedy saw that as an opening. The Democrats, were they worried about that speech afterwards and felt that we have to make this move? And if that was the thinking, how did it turn out so wrong in the end, where you got Ted Kennedy sort of slumping off the stage at the convention?
It's really interesting. There's a good book that's really all about just this speech, the malaise speech. It's called "What the Heck Are You Up to, Mr. President?"
Mm-hmm.
And I'd recommend that to people who want to learn more about this speech. But it was a remarkable speech in many ways. Carter spoke about the country's spiritual psyche. He talked about a spiritual crisis in the country, and I think it may be the last time an American president basically told the American people, in order to meet the challenges we face right now, we all have to sacrifice.
Yeah, see.
And I don't know that that's happened since then.
It hasn't.
And I think
think of it.
And I think part of the reason why it hasn't is because of the way things kind of unfolded in the wake of the speech. Now, when the speech first finished, the immediate reaction on the air, and I went to Vanderbilt and I watched footage from that night, the immediate reception was very positive.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, Carter's poll numbers went up, and the feeling was that he had succeeded. But within the next couple days, he fired the majority of his cabinet on the advice of his chief of staff, Ham Jordan, which I report for the first time, I believe. I haven't seen anybody else report that. I uncovered that in a memo at the Carter Center. But he fires a majority of his cabinet, and the perception or the image that that gives off is that he's kind of flailing around,
mm-hmm.
Acting out of panic and not really sure what he wants to do. And so everything kind of goes back into the ditch after he fires the cabinet. And that's when the speech begins to become known as the malaise speech. And Carter didn't even use that word. It was something that the press basically started to run with. But that speech is remembered very negatively, even though it was a successful speech. And it's very interesting to reflect on the fact that ever since that speech, which was a success, no president has ever really asked the country to sacrifice. I think every president has kind of promised things to the country since then, rather than kind of calling on us to work together and even to sacrifice.
And I think that's an interesting point, because when you go and you look at those other two major moments where you would think a president would do that, 9/11 and the financial meltdown in 2008, President Bush basically told everyone to go shopping.
Right.
And President Obama basically told everyone to go buy a new car. Just, get rid of your hoopty. I'm sorry, I just lost my house. What is what does getting a new car have to do with? So it, you know, there was not this sense of honesty that said to the American people, we are up against the wall here, and we're all going to have to dig a little deeper and make a sacrifice in order to get through this. Very much in line with what his predecessor, Carter's predecessor, FDR, did at the beginning of World War II, where he laid out very clearly what the commitment would need to be, rallied the country. Women entered the workforce as their husbands and brothers and so forth went off to war. The manufacturing industries of the day, converted their plants to turn out product for the war effort. So there was this overwhelming sense that we were in it together. Carter touched on that, but then sort of stepped on his own messaging by following his chief of staff's direction of, sort of on the heels of that speech, firing everybody, which then, of course, is going to take the attention away from the speech. Everybody's going to then decide, oh, this is really what this is about. They have no idea what they're doing.
Yeah, I mean, the references to World War II are interesting because a lot of what you have going on in the 70s is sort of the first come down from the post-war boom that America was really fortunate to experience. You know, the ways that World War II set America up for global dominance are really unique, and we're never probably going to experience that confluence of factors in our history again. It doesn't mean America can't be a global superpower, but there's just things that advantaged us in the world at that point, you know, that we're never going to have that many advantages again. Right. And so the 70s were kind of the first pains of experiencing the end of some of those advantages. We're obviously going through a similar period right now. But I do worry that, our president is accelerating some of those disadvantages.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. And so it's again, how it all kind of plays itself out on many stages. But it's, as you talk about in the book, you know, sort of the inside, the dark chapters, the recesses of political history and political narrative currently, you have these things that roil around, and how the president and how his team and how the leadership responds in those times is critically important. So I guess when you sort of step back and you look at the way Carter started this thing is clearly not how it ended up for Ted Kennedy. Ted Kennedy saw an opening that would advantage him, particularly given his prowess as a political player, the family legend and all of that. What went wrong, and how did that so impact the Democratic Party to this day?
Well, it's super counterintuitive how things went wrong for Kennedy, because when we think of the hostage crisis in Iran now, we think about the political impact of that, most of what we think about is just that it was a big weight on Jimmy Carter in the 1980 election. And it's a big reason why he lost to Ronald Reagan. Mm-hmm. The fact of the matter is, when the hostages were first taken, it helped Carter immensely. And that doesn't make a ton of sense until you kind of look at the specifics, because what happened was, as I said before, the polls showed Kennedy up 2-1 in the fall of 79. And then 3 days before Kennedy announces his candidacy is when the hostages were taken. And so just as Kennedy is ramping up to get going, two things happen. The country rallies around the president, Jimmy Carter, and Kennedy's ability to get into the news cycle and attract news coverage is basically eliminated, because in order for him to make news, he kind of has to talk about the hostages. but he doesn't want to criticize the president because that's going to be politically harmful to him.
Right.
And he doesn't, what is he going to say? Oh, you're doing a great job, Mr. President.
Right.
That's not going to help him politically. So he's really stuck. He's starved of oxygen. And Carter's poll numbers turn around night and day in the matter of a couple of weeks. And so Kennedy is then left running in Iowa ahead of the Iowa caucuses, and it's not a good match for him. Iowans are, as you know, they're not impressed by East Coast celebrity, and they're certainly not going to be super receptive to somebody with a past like Ted Kennedy, given his actions at Chappaquiddick.
Mm-hmm.
And Chappaquiddick was something, if people don't know what that is, that's, you know, a woman was ended up dead in Ted Kennedy's car on Cape Cod, and there are many, you know, theories as to what happened, but he was driving and she died, and he didn't report it for way too long. So, you know, with that in his past, the Kennedy campaign had thought, you know, it's been long enough, people will have forgotten. Well, that turned out not to be quite so true as well. And Iowa was just a really bad match for him. So the Kennedy people hadn't really thought about, you know, whether or not they were a good match in Iowa, because their poll numbers were so good, they just thought, we're just going to steamroll them. But then the hostage crisis happens. It turns everything upside down. And Kennedy's running in a state that he's not well suited for. And he ends up getting crushed in Iowa.
And isn't it true also that Carter was much more of a political bruiser than people give him credit for? They think about the naval physicist and, you know, the sort of really smart guys, one of the smartest men to hold the office. And, you know, sort of the nerdy kind of peanut farmer image. But politically, particularly with Roslyn behind her, who was woefully underestimated in her ability to maneuver politically behind the scenes, together, but certainly Carter on his own, was a pretty formidable political opponent. And that's something I think the Kennedy people really underestimated in calculating. Yes, you had extenuating events like the hostage crisis, which kind of colors and sort of misshapes your ability to kind of really go at it. You know, like you said, you don't want to sit there and go, President, you're really screwing this up, or gee, you're doing a great job. So it's a no win. But still, it made it, you know, it would have been even without, I think, without the hostage crisis, it probably would have been a little bit more prickly for Kennedy anyway.
Yeah, and there were people who had predicted that. I think Henry Kissinger, if memory serves, was one person who predicted that. But one of my favorite things about researching and writing this book, and I hope it's one of the things that readers enjoy about it as well, is just sort of coming to know both these characters, Jimmy Carter and Ted Kennedy, much in a much deeper way,
mm-hmm.
with much more substance and nuance and texture. Because, you know, we have these impressions about historical figures, and they're often caricatures. And I think that's very true of both of these men. And, you know, the caricature of Jimmy Carter is basically that, you know, he wore a sweater and was kind of a wimp.
Right.
And Hunter Thompson, the famous Gonzo writer, has this great quote. And probably maybe my favorite chapter is the one where Hunter Thompson is present at the first meeting between Carter and Kennedy in 1974. It's just an amazing story. But Thompson said that Carter was one of the three meanest people he had ever met, along with Muhammad Ali and the founder of Hell's Angels. And what Thompson was getting at there, it's a great quote. What Thompson was getting at there was that Carter, if he thought it was the right thing to do, would really go after you politically. And he sat there and watched Carter give a speech in 1974 in Atlanta or in Georgia, where he sort of just sort of laced into a room of political elites in Georgia and gave it just full-throated populist speech. And one of the really interesting things I found in Carter's life story is that he ran for governor in 66 and lost.
Mm-hmm.
And he ran a pretty progressive
campaign on race. But the eventual winner was Lester Maddox, who was a racist and segregationist. In between 1966 and 1970, when Carter ran again, he went on two trips up north. One of them was to Massachusetts, where he went door to door helping start a new Baptist church. He was basically evangelizing.
Right.
And he had a period of spiritual epiphany. He was reading Christian philosophy and was going through a period of sort of a reawakening spiritually in his faith walk. But the interesting sort of conclusion of all this was that he sort of imbued his political activity with almost a divine mandate in a way that I think allowed him to ignore or overlook politically unsavory things that were done by his campaigns, because it was all in the service of a greater good.
Right.
So, for example, in 1970, he ran a much more friendly campaign to the racist, segregationist whites in Georgia. And he won the governorship in 1970, you know, in large part because they supported him. So it's just a very interesting, and I have the highest regard for Jimmy Carter's character and integrity, but that's a real sort of dark mark on his record.
Yeah, and I think that it speaks volumes about, you know, these men and you know, possibly in likely future women candidates running for the highest office, how they are forged in that fire, and how they do try to, in Carter's case, an example, you know, keep that faith walk going. But then, you know, they get to a certain stop or a certain corner or a certain bend in the road, and they kind of turn their head the other way because they don't want to see exactly what's happening at that moment. And they'll look elsewhere because others are doing the act and not them. You know, the worst thing you can say about him is he softened his rhetoric. It's what the campaign was doing underneath that. That really speaks more about where the candidate is and how the candidate is maneuvering. And it's always a much more interesting story. And I think we've seen examples of that in the 2015-2016 cycle, certainly. And the difference is that we have now a president who operationally does those things himself directly. He doesn't worry about it. He doesn't need anybody else to do it for him. He just goes out and does it directly. So it makes for a very, very interesting contrast. It's a great book, folks. You got to pick it up. Again, as we get ready to talk about it, I want to grab you on a couple other things before I do, remind folks, the book is Camelot's End, Kennedy versus Carter and the Fight That Broke the Democratic Party. You got to check it out. So having that storyline that you've written now and sort of delved into from a historic point, how, as you look at the politics of today, and the one thing I really admire about you, and we've had a few conversations in this area, is this whole idea of faith and the role of religion, and the impact of, you know, those aspects of one's life on how they govern, how they lead, and how policy is set and all of that. How do you see what's happening now, particularly with respect to the federal government shutdown? Nancy Pelosi framed this as a moral argument, that there's a moral component here that we need to be concerned about. Was that more political theater and just kind of putting it in that context to put the bar so high that, you know, you're kind of straining your neck to look at it? Or was there a genuine philosophical sort of faith component here that should also be considered in looking at how the government responds in these situations?
Well, I do think that when you think about the impact of the shutdown on real people, that does get into territory that's imbued with a faith perspective, because you know, a big reason why many Americans believe that every human life has dignity is based in Christian theology.
Mm-hmm.
You know, every human life has dignity and inherent worth because it's made in the image of God. And so that's certainly sort of the foundation for a lot of our principles that we enter into politics with. I think, you know, trying to then, I don't know if this is the right word, but it's coming to mind, trying to kind of pastiche that onto your preferred outcome in the government shutdown can be problematic. I think it's not quite as clumsy as someone like David Barton, who's this fundamentalist conservative who kind of takes the Bible and says God is in favor of a low individual tax rate. It's not quite that bad.
Right.
But I do think you're getting into tricky territory anytime you try to to say that God's on your side in politics. That's anytime I hear people say that, I think you have to be skeptical. That's not an automatic disqualifier. I do think if you're saying God's on our side of the argument that murder is wrong, yeah, but like most things in politics are not that clear cut.
They're not that clear cut. And where, you know, I guess for me, though, where it becomes a little bit more clear cut in this environment is how some in the evangelical community who berated Americans for 30 plus years, certainly since the days of the moral majority, going back into the 80s and 90s, about how they lived, who they loved, what they did, you know, whether or not they were even Christian and all of that. Suddenly, when it got to Trump, said, wait a minute, we'll just kind of ignore all those immoral things and acts and words and deeds because we get a Supreme Court justice out of the deal or we get a tax cut out of the deal. And that to me is more morally offensive. If I'm going to put a moral wrapping around you know, the behavior of individuals, the policies, et cetera, you know, for example, locking kids in cages. That's where I think the selective moral outrage to me is the most galling. And I agree with you 1,000% whenever I hear a candidate sit there and talk about, you know, God is on my side on this. I'm like, okay, let's have a conversation because, you know, I don't think we want to lead with that from the campaign's perspective. But how do you see that? I mean, am I off base in looking at the way some today are sort of selectively applying their morality around these things and sort of it again, like I said in the last when we were talking about Carter, you know, you're doing that faith walk, but then you get to a certain bend in the road and you don't look to see exactly what's going on there. You kind of turn your head the other way.
No, I mean, you're not wrong at all. I mean, the evangelical, the white, let's be precise here, because many African Americans are evangelical in their theology, but that term evangelical refers to white Protestant,
yes,
often non-denominational Christians. And the white evangelical conservative movement in America, there's just no question that they are massively hypocritical on this issue of the importance of public character in office. And I don't know that many of them would admit to hypocrisy.
Right.
I think a lot of them would just say, well, you know, circumstances have changed. And I think what you have happening at the bottom of it all is what I kind of refer to as an apocalyptic mindset. There's a lot that goes into it, but I think at the bottom of that apocalyptic mindset, there's this feeling that if America doesn't go the way that I sort of have been conditioned to think it should, according to my sort of white evangelical worldview, and some of that is sort of moral and religious, some of it's less so.
Right.
But if America doesn't go the way I think it should be going, then there's something wrong with all of reality. When in reality, you know, a true faith perspective says the kingdom of God goes forward regardless.
Yeah.
Regardless of whether America is prospering, the kingdom of God is not threatened. You know, the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. And right. so there does seem to me sometimes to be a conflation among people who have had a large amount of the sort of benefits of America for the last several decades. I think there's been a conflation of sort of what success for the kingdom of God means mm-hmm. and success for America means. And they now see sort of America's future as intertwined with their own sort of faith perspective, their own the viability of their own faith.
And in a real way, John, race and racism is still intertwined and wrapped up in that as well. And it is an interesting component to the faith narrative for some that I find
absolutely
really intriguing. And as you were talking, I was sitting there thinking about what we've just witnessed with Steve King, Congressman Steve King from Iowa, and how, you know, finally, you know, some of the GOP have said, oh, okay, well, this is a bridge too far. And I'm like, wait a minute. Now we're at a bridge too far. So you realize it's more politics pushing that than some real moral yeah. enlightenment that, damn, I mean, this guy is an anathema to the ideals that we purportedly espouse. But instead, oh, it's now more of a political inconvenience. And I think a lot of Americans have kind of seen through that in their response to the Republican Party's response to Steve King with mm-hmm. the idea of censuring him and or removing him of all of his committee assignments, et cetera. And it to me, just it's always been one of those things inside the party that, you know, you deal with in polite company, I guess, and you try to, but you also try to understand and you try to show we can't go out and say this stuff because people see it, you know, see it very differently. We can't go out there and pretend, you know, that what he's saying or what he has said in the past doesn't matter, and now all of a sudden it does.
Yeah, you know, I have a mixed response to that because on the one hand, that could be discouraging that people don't, you know, respond to what's obviously a wrong thing to say. They don't respond the right way necessarily for the right reasons, right? I mean, that's kind of what you're getting at.
Right.
But I think that history kind of shows us that kind of like in wrestling, people don't move to where they need to be unless it's uncomfortable to be in the position they're in right now.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking of something I read recently where Carol Anderson, who's a professor at Emory, she wrote a book called One Person, No Vote about the issue of voter rights, about the ways that voter rights have been infringed since
right.
the Shelby decision, which is kind of a much overlooked and an underappreciated fact. But her point was, and I need to do more research into the history of this to know how definitively true it was, to know how much of a picture this was. But her point was that the civil rights movement gained traction in the 50s and 60s, in some part because the foreign policy establishment in America and in American government felt like they were not able to prosecute the sort of global argument against the Soviet Union when we had this black mark on our record. We were trying to say to the Soviet Union, we're a superior democracy with equal rights and freedom for all. And they were able to point back and say, no, you're not. And
right.
so
right.
it wasn't so much out of the goodness of people's hearts that there began to become a movement for civil rights in America. It was as much just sort of realpolitik and a need to sort of move the needle against the Soviets. I thought that was very interesting. And I think more often than not, when you study history, that's the way it works.
Yeah, I think you're right. And it is interesting. And more often than not, that is how it works. And it's It's enlightening, I think, for a lot of people. And you're right. It's something that you got to look at and really kind of understand in the long run. And it's a lot of people don't, I guess, is what the bottom line is. One other thing I wanted to touch on. It's a little bit. Okay, so we all watch the National Football College Championship, and the Clemson Tigers won going away. Just killer.
I don't think I watched it. I think I was coming down with pneumonia.
Yeah, that's when you were having another issue you had to watch and pay attention to.
A
lot of folks kind of watched that. And of course, they win the game. So, you know, traditional fashion, the team comes to the White House to be celebrated by the president.
Oh, okay. I was wondering where you're going with that.
Yeah, so the team comes to the White House to be celebrated by the president. Okay, so here's the deal. So the president says, in response to the Clemson Tigers coming to the White House, that, quote, "I think we're going to serve McDonald's, Wendy's, and Burger King's with some pizza." I mean, I really mean it, you know? It'll be interesting. I would think that's their favorite food, so we'll see what happens. Well, lo and behold, they show up, and there is, amidst the chandeliers of the White House, cheeseburgers, hamburgers, Big Macs, Whoppers, pizza. And the response was pretty much a flat burger. I think a lot of people kind of shook their head and went, "What the hell? Seriously? I mean, postpone the event, number one. There's nothing worse, number two, than eating cold hamburgers." Because, yeah. I'm sorry, even the best heat lamps in the world, it's nothing like taking it fresh off the griddle, right? So,
right, that's true.
I think that's such a symbol for so much of where this administration looks at these, how this administration looks at these types of events, that they dumb them down to their lowest common denominator, and you get cold hamburger or pizza.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many things you could say. I mean, I did find it. I mean, I don't know how I intentionally didn't read a ton about it. I just sort of like saw it,
right,
and then I moved on. I did wonder how the players felt about it. I mean, maybe they liked it. I don't know, but I found it to be sad and sort of embarrassing. But I also, every time one of these stories pops up, I think about the people I know who voted for Trump. I mean, many of the people in my family did. And I love those people and I respect them and I want to treat them with respect. And,
right.
And I also engage in political conversation in a way that's winsome to them.
Right.
And so I think a lot of times with stories like this, they feel two things. They feel like, one, this is getting blown up beyond, you know, its importance, which I could agree with him on the one hand, and then I could also say, look, especially since television's come along, that's just what political news has been about. But I also do think a lot of the Trump coverage is overly has too much animus towards the president.
Yeah, yeah.
So I understand the animus. I think the press oftentimes lets ourselves sort of do too much of that. And then I think the other thing they feel sometimes is looked down upon or scorned.
Yeah.
So I want to try to avoid that too. But it's funny because, like, you know, Roland Martin, he's probably a friend of yours.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know.
Oh, yeah,
you guys
know
each other
very well. Yeah.
I mean, we were talking about this, and he's basically like, you know, Trump's got the votes of your family. Like, you can try, but good luck.
Yeah.
and so that might be true. But I still think it's important to love my neighbor.
No, it is. It is. And I just have fun with the story. My view of it is I don't think it's appropriate. If the reason is there's a government shutdown and the White House personnel who would be involved in catering this event are furloughed and therefore not there, then postpone the event. And you can do it at another time when you can do it appropriately. On the other hand, yeah, I can see the fun of it. And doing the hamburger thing, I think, could be a lot of fun as well. But it's just the way, I think, when you put it in the context of everything else that the administration is doing and has done, it really just strikes people. There were some people trying to draw some racial, overtones or undertones to it as well, as like, you know, you've got these athletes, a significant number of whom are African American, and now, oh, you're just going to serve them fast food, you know. So I was like, okay, we're getting a little crazy here, just dial it back a little bit. But at the same time, it is so typically Trump in so many ways.
Well, I mean,
guess.
having said what I said about Trump and coverage of Trump and Trump supporters, I felt like I often feel like I need to say that sort of thing just to preface other things. But yeah, having said all that, you know, when you look at the image of Trump standing in front of a photo of Abraham Lincoln in the, I believe it was the East Room,
right?
But in the White House, it's a sad statement on sort of the ways that he has belittled and lowered the office of the presidency and besmirched it in many ways, yeah, by his behavior.
Well, it made for a fun storyline this week, and in the face of all the very painful storylines that are out there for a lot of federal employees and their families, it's a stark reminder that there's some real important things going on, and you can even in those moments you can find something amusing coming out of the White House from time to time. So hamburgers and all.
I don't have any good like direct quotes out of this, but you often hear people talk about how, you know, the best medicine for tough times is laughter.
And, yeah.
And I do think that in the political conversation, a lot of times people are a little too serious.
Yeah.
You know, things are important, things are serious, but, you know, probably the best thing you can do to get through it sometimes is just to have a sense of humor.
That's it. Well, I appreciate you, man, so much. John Ward, he's an incredible journalist, folks, and follow him on Twitter at John Ward 11, and certainly check out his work at Yahoo News, and pick up a copy of the book. It's well worth the read. Camelot's End: Kennedy versus Carter and the Fight That Broke the Democratic Party. John Ward, thanks for hanging out with the Man of Steel, bro.
Mike, good to be with you.
All right, man. Take care. Well, got to get out of here. As you know, you can always find us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, or wherever you get your podcasts on. And you can find me on Twitter at Michael Steele. But before I go, just want to just raise one little thing with you. You know, it happens to most of us at some point or another. Debt just sort of creeps up on you. You know how that is? How many of us have looked at our finances and screamed, "How can we make this much and still have so much debt?" Unexpected repairs, replacing the washer and dryer, medical bills, and of course the killer, those insane interest credit cards you had to use to pay for it all, right? Here's a really smart move that could help you get on top of your finances. Get a quick 3-2-1. Get a fixed rate personal loan at bestegg.com. The rates are great right now. And now imagine finally being able to pay down those crazy high credit cards and bills, and then bank the money you save each month. Consumers have rated Best Egg 4.8 out of 5 stars on Consumer Affairs because of the super easy online app that takes about a minute with no impact to your credit score. Upon approval, funds can be deposited in as little as one business day. So get your bills under control, bank what you save, and take control of your finances with a loan from bestegg.com. Visit bestegg.com/plan. That's bestegg.com/plan. All right, folks, that does it for this time. Check us out on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, wherever you get your podcasts on. All right, stay tuned for more good stuff from the Man of Steel coming at you. Check it out.
Stay.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.